Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Dr. Tom Reese. He's a surgeon, writer, and sculptor, and he's the author of the book Doctari, A Surgeon's Adventures with the Flying Doctors of East Africa. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And not only are you the author of this book, but you have an exhibition of bronze sculptures, which is going to be at the Gerald Peters Gallery for several more weeks. You were a very well-trained surgeon, plastic surgeon, went to the best schools, and found yourself through what you yourself call kind of fate in Africa, doing surgery on people who had almost nothing. How did that happen?
Well, it happened. I was having, under the last year of my training, I was had a fellowship in England working under a very famous English plastic surgeon who was famed for working on the burned RAF pilots from Battle of Britain. And he went to Africa every winter. He had a farm there, and that was his R&R. And while he was there, he did some demonstrating, some reconstructive surgery, because there was, at that time, no plastic surgeon in all of East Africa, an area about the size of Western Europe. So in the winter of 56, I was with him in England, and he said, well, I'm going to Africa. Would you like to go? And I said, sure, I'd love to go. So I went with him to Africa, and that started a new episode of my life that's continued on until the present time.
So what was the Flying Doctors of East Africa? How did it start? I mean, you went around in airplanes.
Well, as we arrived there, the first plastic surgeon in East Africa also arrived to set up his practice in Nairobi. He was an Englishman, and the three of us were operating on some burn patients and some cleft lip patients and so forth, and we thought, well, we better try to do something about all of these deformities which were getting no care otherwise, especially people in the rural areas in the bush were getting nothing. So we decided, on the spur of the moment, that we would start trying to help these people by flying surgeons who would come to Africa as volunteers, plastic surgeons. And the only way we could really get them around in the countryside was by small aircraft, because the roads were terrible. Especially in the rainy season, you couldn't get anywhere. So we bought a little airplane, and we learned to fly it. And that started the Flying Doctors, and it was in 1957 that we really got started. And then we incorporated this Flying Doctors of East Africa into an organization known as the African Medical Research Foundation, with the acronym AMREF, which is really the parent organization of the Flying Doctors. And it started with this very simple little beginning with one airplane, until today we have a fleet of airplanes and a large staff. We have 1,000 staff, and we're very proud of the fact that 98% of them are Africans.
Is that right?
Yeah. It sort of grew like Topsy, you know. I never expected this to become this huge organization that it is today.
Now, when you think about, at least when I think about plastic surgery, I think of, movie stars wanting to get their faces rearranged and so on. But the need for plastic surgery in Africa is a completely different thing.
Well, not really. They have all the same need for reconstructive surgery that we have here, but only more so, and some other rare deformities and diseases that we don't see much here, like animal bites.
But, I mean, they don't say, I want to get a facelift.
No, they don't hardly say that. These are people who are severely deformed. And in a lot of third world countries especially, people who are very deformed become social outcasts. They become beggars. Such things that are simple to repair as a hair lip, for example, which is quite a simple operation. There, if they're not repaired, they become beggars. Their families kick them out. And the same goes for leprosy, deformities, burns. then they have some rather unusual tropical lesions that we don't see here. But all in all, it's plastic. Plastic is really a word, Greek word, that means to shape or form. And plastic surgery, in its larger context and sense, encompasses reconstructive surgery. So it's really kind of hard to separate aesthetic surgery from reconstructive surgery. It kind of overlaps. But in those areas of the world where there's very little in the way of facilities to take care of these people, we reached out to the rural areas to take care of rural, first of all, plastic surgery patients, and then subsequently patients with HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, children's diseases of all kinds. And we are basically an educational organization. We train community-based village health workers, very low-level health workers. In most of those small villages in Africa will never have doctors or nurses ever. And they rely on a health worker. So that's our major thrust. But the flying doctors still does what we started out to do. We fly surgical teams all over East Africa, but now more than just plastic surgery teams. We send general surgery teams, urology teams, vesicovaginal fistula teams, eye surgeons. And they go out and we cover an area, like I said, the size of Western Europe. Basically Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Somalia, Sudan. We're in Ethiopia. And we use these as training missions also. We don't just go out and operate on people. We take learning young surgeons who need to learn these techniques, go out with our experienced surgeons to help with that work.
One of the first people whom you operated on was a man who was attacked by a rhinoceros, and you had very few implements, and it was a pretty scary moment because you were used to being in a hospital with all sorts of backup systems, and you had nothing.
Yeah, basically, I had nothing. I had a little.
You had scotch.
I had a little kit of instruments. I had a bottle of scotch. I had a little bit of local. But, you know, when you're faced with a situation like that, and this was out in the middle of Tanzania, a long way away from any hospital, you just have to do it. You have to make use of what you have available. Yeah, and it was a pretty scary moment. It was actually the first major sort of disastrous case I ever ran into in Africa. And fortunately, I got him through it, or he got himself through it. I think he was just really a tough man, and he survived the surgery without modern equipment and without recovery rooms and all the things that we have here.
Or even anesthesia.
Whiskey's a pretty old anesthetic.
Right. Now, the thing that you saw in him and that you saw subsequently was a kind of incredible toughness in some of these African people who really didn't have a whole lot of Western influence in their lives. Their ability to withstand pain and to just breathe through it or whatever they did is almost unbelievable to a person reading it or to you perceiving it.
Well, they are stoic, too. You know, they're used to discomfort and disease and even pain from the time they're young. And because they don't know any better, they just learn how to deal with it and withstand it. I'm not saying they don't experience the pain or the discomfort. They probably do, but they deal with it differently than we do. You know, here we tend, if we get a sniffle, we run to the doctor and find out what's going on. And there they just can't. They just don't. So they do have this incredible fortitude and strength. And it's an inner strength they have to face these disasters of health and life. So as patients, they're very good patients because they cooperate with you. They're, of course, immensely grateful, although they don't show it exactly the way European patients or Western patients do. But they have the same diseases and same disease processes, but they manage to deal with it on a personal level a little better probably than we do. We're all spoiled in the West anyway.
There is an interesting moment where you said that gratitude or the expression of gratitude really is a cultural construct, and a lot of times you'd save somebody's life or save their child and give the child back to the mother, and her expression would remain completely neutral and she'd take it and walk away.
Yeah, that was true, and it was a little bit disheartening in the beginning until I realized that she probably was grateful, but they just don't express it that way. I mean, the word thank you is not a word widely used in the bush in Africa.
Now, you were there doing all sorts of operations. How did you organize this? I mean, you would show up at a village and say, show us your deformed people and we will heal them?
No, we formed a network where they knew well in advance when we were coming. We now visit about 180 hospitals, and we established a radio network with all of these hospitals so that they would know when a surgical team was coming, and they would triage the patients. They would save the patients, and then they would have them there at the hospital the day you come or the 2 days you were there. So it wasn't just hit and miss. You know, it was all very, now it's very carefully planned and done because it's too valuable a resource to waste. And with the use of radios and modern equipment, such as radios, it makes this sort of thing possible.
You, by necessity, found yourself doing a lot of surgeries that weren't planned for, and you also found yourself really learning the art of diagnosis, which includes a good dose of intuition as well as scientific method.
Yes, true, especially if you don't speak the language. And the universal language in East Africa is Swahili, which I picked up some of it as I went along, but didn't speak it fluently. But fortunately, we always had somebody to interpret. But yes, I mean, the art of medicine is something we could spend the whole rest of the hour talking about. The art of medicine is being able to really sense when somebody's really sick, something really wrong or not. You had to use intuition a lot with all of the patients, especially, as I say, if you're not communicating verbally as well as you would like, you have to kind of, and sometimes it's very scary because you have to walk away sometimes from a patient that you really wonder about. You think, well, maybe they're really very sick and maybe I just haven't figured it out and I don't have to have an x-ray machine on my right or a blood test or anything to do. So that made it challenging very often.
What were some of the signals that you observed in the absence of medical technology that tipped you off that somebody was really sick?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer. You know, it's sort of their body attitude, how they're sitting, how they're lying in bed. I mean, even the way they're looking at you, sometimes you can pick that up. Very few people in that part of the world sham illness. You know, they just don't do that.
Right. Because I was thinking about in Chinese medicine, they teach you to look for certain things, the way the eyes are, the way the tongue is, and all of that. And I imagine that those are universal things that you were doing as well.
Yeah, but I wasn't trained in Chinese medicine, so
right.
I didn't have the advantage of knowing that.
Now, one of the things that you saw often was people who were burned, and the reason for those burns were often that they cooked over open fires.
Yeah, they still cook over open fires mostly, and particularly children who have neurological illnesses like epilepsy or something can fall into the fire and get badly burned, or fall in the fire anyway, little toddlers, you know. So burns are a significant problem. In the absence of learning how to do a simple skin graft, for example, a lot of those burns heal with very terrible deformities that are not only cosmetically terrible, but are functionally very bad.
Getting there years after the burn happened, I mean, you're not there right away. You see these people who are very scarred. Were you able to do something to help them?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we can. We remove the scar, all of it or part of it, and repair the area with skin grafts. But the other thing about that we embarked in a program of teaching, if there was a doctor in that hospital, he may not be a surgeon, or certainly not a plastic surgeon. We taught those doctors how to do a simple skin graft. Skin is not a terribly difficult procedure. I could teach you how to do it in about an hour. But if they didn't know how to do it, then they wouldn't cover the burns early on when the burns should be covered with skin graft so that it would heal properly. So we that was one of our little educational things that we did a lot of with not only burns, but we did with nurses, teaching techniques as we go along.
So that was something that you were doing from the beginning, which is teaching local people how to do some of the things that you did.
Yes.
Did they have, I mean, you couldn't really teach surgery, though. I mean, you could teach certain things and not others.
No, that's true. You can't teach surgery. You can teach a surgeon who is not trained in certain techniques how to do, as I say, you could teach him how to do a skin graft or teach him how to even repair a hair lip. And the nurses there do a certain amount of surgery. For example, tubal ligations.
Right.
They do a lot of tubal ligations, and nurses are taught that.
Now, there were a number of conditions that you saw that were the direct result of cultural practices, like female genital mutilation.
Yes, that is still a common problem. There's been a lot of educational effort by the part of the government and health organizations to stop that practice because it's sociologically and culturally, in a lot of places, a young woman who has not been circumcised is not eligible for marriage. The idea behind that was so that it would lessen her sexual desires and arousal so she wouldn't be apt to stray. And it's a terrible procedure. I mean, it can be very mutilating. It can even interfere with giving birth to babies. Fortunately, a lot of the recent educational efforts have been towards the men, to convince the men that this is a bad practice for everybody's. And there, it is making headway in certain places, but not as much as it should. It's still common.
There are some incredible East African women activists whom we've had on the air, mm-hmm. like Agnes Pereo, who are starting safe houses for young women to escape from genital mutilation.
Yeah. The problem, though, is to escape from it, again, you have the problem of this young woman's future, her marriage. I've met a woman who was a diplomat in New York City at the UN, who was from Kenya. I met her through some social sources, and she asked me if I would circumcise her daughter. I said, absolutely not. She said, well, I'll have to take her back to Kenya then and get it done, because otherwise she can't get married. When I'm through with my term of work in New York, I go back home. And she did that. And so, as I say, that's a cultural, it's an ethical, moral problem, but it's a cultural problem, too.
We're talking to Dr. Tom Rees. So, other problems that you found there, preventable illnesses that people were getting very sick from or dying from. What were some other things you saw?
Well, treating infant diarrhea, which is a major killer, and that can be treated quite often with a simple solution of salt and water, getting fluids into those kids. The natural inclination for let's say a very, very rural African woman, when she sees her child having diarrhea, losing all that fluid, the first thing she does is stop giving the kid fluid,
right,
because she figures that that's the problem. And of course, that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. So another example that's more recent is this terrible problem of malaria, which has come back. You know, in the late 60s, we had the World Malaria Eradication Program. And for a while, we thought we had solved that. But it is now back, and it's back with a vengeance. Every minute that you and I sit here, one child dies of malaria in this world. And a simple thing like a bed net,
a mosquito net.
Mosquito net is treated, will save 90% of that.
Right.
And that's what I mean by, you know, some simple, and they're not very expensive, mosquito net. And there are organizations that distribute them, including ours.
Leprosy was something you saw. What is leprosy?
Leprosy is caused by a bacteria, a bacillus, which is very similar to the tuberculosis bacillus under a microscope. It's hard to tell the difference. And leprosy, we don't see a lot of in the Western world. It's not related to hygiene. It's related to it's a bacteria, and it eventually ends up destroying the nerves. And then when you destroy the nerves and the patient has no sensation in their fingers or their hands, then they tend to get a sore that, because the sore doesn't hurt. They don't treat it. And it goes on to cause deformities such as that or facial paralysis. So there are still, quote, leprosariums in Africa, but there is progress being made in terms of diagnosis. Again, teaching people in rural hospitals, even nurses or nurse practitioners, how to recognize the early signs and symptoms of leprosy.
It is an interesting example of the positive function of pain in a person's body.
That's what pain is, isn't it? Pain is saying to us there's something wrong here. You know, let's find out what's wrong.
Right.
And if you don't have the sensation of pain, you just don't pay attention.
So leprosy, it's a bacterium, there are antibiotics, but there's also more and more resistant strains that are resistant to antibiotics.
Yep. Like tuberculosis, the current strain of tuberculosis that is all immune to almost all, I don't mean immune, it's drug fast, to almost all the drugs that we've used, so therefore it's very dangerous.
Right.
And I'm not sure where it came from, this current killer, tuberculosis, but it was found in the Russian prisons. And now it's spreading a lot in the third world, especially.
So when you were observing the health practices, I mean, you were obviously bringing a lot of things that people didn't have, and they were very grateful, and you were curing conditions and deformities and so on. Did you also observe the local healing practices? There's one place in your book where you say their practices are more art than science. What kind of practices, healing practices, effective healing practices, did you see?
Oh, everything from hot stones to gathering, almost, you know, like shamans anywhere. They gather certain plants, certain weeds. We have active programs with, they're called traditional doctors, not witch doctors anymore.
Right.
So we have very active programs in cooperation with traditional doctors as we speak in several places in Africa. They certainly have their role and their place because the people believe them. They believe in them.
And did you see some of the herbs being, Lord knows we take herbs, I take herbs out of the yard for stomach aches and things like that.
One of the things they do quite widely is scarify. They take a sharp instrument and make little scars all over people, on their abdomens especially. And then they put ashes so that it'll fester and result in an elevated scar. And you can spot those. They're very characteristic as opposed to tribal tattoos or markings. These witch doctor markings, traditional doctors, are seen mostly on the body.
And what is there a medical purpose to them?
No, I think it's just it's certainly demonstrative. The patients realize something is happening.
You had quite a bit of contact with missionaries who were in Africa, and for a lot of people who are, you know, thinking about missionaries today, we think, oh boy, here's people who are going and trying to change the customs and religions and so on of people, and how would we feel if they were doing that to us? What was your experience of missionaries working in Africa?
Well, like everything else, there are good ones and there are bad ones, you know, or there are useless ones and they're very effective. Most of the missionaries I had contact with were medical. They were doctors and nurses, and they were much more concerned about health care than they were about proselytizing people. It's very popular these days to knock the missionaries, but they did a tremendous job of educating people in Africa, Asia, everywhere else. Probably the idea that they try to change people's too fast, maybe, or convert them is valid in a way, but again, if you balance it out on a scale of what good they did as opposed to what bad they did or ineffectiveness, I think they did a terrific job in the area of medicine, especially. Most of those hospitals in the bush in Africa were missionary hospitals. The governments couldn't afford those hospitals. and most of them have been taken over by the government now.
Another unusual injury that you came across was somebody who had gotten an arrow shot into his body, into his chest, that pierced his stomach by somebody who thought that he was sleeping with this guy's wife. So he shot him with an arrow. The man walked 25 miles with an arrow sticking out of his body,
yes.
Went to a hospital, and lived to tell the tale.
Yep. Yep. That happens. That kind of thing happens, you know, more often than you would think.
It's unbelievable.
As I say, it is unbelievable. But they wanted to get to the nearest medical facility, so away they go.
I mean, I was thinking, oh boy, somebody's shooting another man with an arrow. But I was like, well, I suppose we do that with guns here for the exact same reasons.
Yeah.
So here you are. There's one more story that I wanted you to talk about, which was kind of amazing to me. There was a man who was a very kind of macho-looking, tall and broad and beefy trophy elephant hunter. And he came to you and he wanted breast implants.
Yeah. His name was Tony. That was a long time ago. And he was just the antithesis of what you would think a cross-sexual or transsexual person would be. But he wanted breast implants. And my colleague and I, who by then was in practicing in Nairobi, we talked to him at great length because that kind of surgery can be very tricky.
Especially in the early 60s.
In the early 60s. Well, the surgery isn't tricky. The surgery was rather simple. But to understand the psychological aspects of the patient that you're dealing with is very important that you have a full psychological evaluation spectrum. We didn't have that there. So we talked to this man quite at length about really what he wanted to do. And he said that he just always wanted to have breasts. He'd always felt more like a woman than a man, and that his wife agreed, and that she would agree to live with him after had this done as in marriage. They had children, by the way. So we did it, and I lost track of him. I don't know what happened to him in the end.
So, I mean, amazing, unusual things that happened to you. So you did this for years. How long were you doing surgery in Africa? I mean, you were also practicing in the United States and just going to Africa each year.
Yeah. My wife and I would go we'd go 6 weeks or so every year, every winter time, and do this. Not because we're altruistic or, you know, want to save the world or anything, but it was great fun, you know. It was venturesome. It was fun. And in the last analysis, we felt like we'd done something rather than just have a big city plastic surgery practice, which I had in New York City. So it kind of kept me sane, kept me honest, I think.
I think also, as other surgeons came into the Flying Doctors of East Africa and were trained, there's so much that you see in those situations and so many practical ways of coping and doing your job that you learn in the bush that you're not going to learn in a big city hospital.
Yes, true. You just have to make do with a lot less and a lot simpler. For example, you can use wire coat hangers to hang IVs from. A lot of little tricks like that. But I'm glad to say that nowadays the Flying Doctors have, when we go out on a surgical mission, we have full everything. We go with an anesthetist, we go with a scrub nurse, we bring our own instruments, we have almost a portable ER that goes with us.
Right. So what are some of the, I mean, that's a great example. That's something I want to ask you about. What are some of the improvements in this group, in the Flying Doctors, compared to the way it was? I mean, you had a little propeller plane that you were flying around, and you didn't even have, you know, global positioning satellites or anything.
No, that's true. We now have some pretty sophisticated airplanes. We have two large. We have a jet, access to a jet. We sometimes evacuate people to Europe, but we have some pretty sophisticated airplanes. Two of them are fitted out. If you went into one of them, if I showed you pictures, you'd think you were in a modern emergency room or small operating room. We have a fleet of airplanes now. We've flown over 21 million miles over the years, and we've had only one accident in that time.
You've also trained, as you said at the beginning, many African doctors. How did that whole program, rather than getting volunteers from Europe and the United States, you were finding people locally?
Yeah, well, the volunteer program is really a not very effective way to do it. We still have volunteers, but when it takes a certain amount of experience to be effective in a rural or bush situation. And we found out that the medical students, and they have a medical school in Nairobi, and they have one in Uganda. We found out that the medical students there had gone to school, gone to college, then gone to medical school, and always lived in the cities. They'd never been out in the bush much. And when they finish medical training, which is paid for by the government, they have to do 2 years mandatory service with the government to pay for their medical. And a lot of them are then stationed out in rural areas. So we worked out a deal with the medical school and the government to take training, doctors in training, especially surgeons, with us to go out on these, what we call outreach, surgical visits with our experienced people so they learn how to function and operate in a rural hospital. They learn how to adapt maybe a step down from what they're used to, but very practical for them because they're going to spend a lot of time there. And it was very popular, still is. It was a very popular program, not only with the government and the medical school, but with the medical students and the residents and interns who go out with us.
When they go out there, do they then do public health education and teach people how to prevent certain easy-to-prevent illnesses, things like that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's been more and more of their training, as it is. You know, when I went to medical school in the United States, we had very little time on public health. All we learned about were sewer systems and very boring stuff. We thought it was extremely boring. And not today. Today, I mean, you know, the emphasis on public health, preventive medicine, you see it all the time. Epidemics, this thing that's going on right now, swine flu, is terribly interesting.
HIV obviously has become a big problem. It didn't exist when you started doing this work in the 60s. I guess it was the very first cases were what, in the
70s?
Late 70s. So how did you see this epidemic growing in Africa, and what was your, did the flying doctors do anything with prevention and treatment and so on?
Yes, when it first came out, they didn't know what it was. They called it Slim's disease because people just got slim, and died. And then when they discovered what was going on, it had already reached epidemic proportions, and there's a lot of reasons for it, traditions, promiscuity, and so forth, which is much too much for us to go into. But of interest, the first country that really recognized the problem and said, yes, we have this problem, is Uganda. At that point, Uganda was about 25% HIV positive. And they recognized the problem, and they came to many organizations such as ours and say, hey, we've got a problem, will you help us? So we were able to instigate some educational projects in Uganda, especially starting with school children. Because it's too late, you can't train the grown-up men to change their ways. So you have to train the kids take it home to the mothers, and the mothers, you know, do what they can. Through an educational program, through posters and teaching and so forth, they brought the Uganda rate down to 8%, which is smaller than any country in Africa that I know of.
You know,
we still have 40% in South Africa, 30% in Botswana, but now it's climbing back up again. And this whole thing is the question of how do you change people's behavior?
I mean, the sexual behaviors, we know what sexual behaviors are. And we've had this problems in the United States. We have problems everywhere with HIV. What are some of the other behaviors that have made HIV spread so terribly in Africa?
We had a lot of interference with teaching people about HIV. For example, condoms. A lot of African men don't like them, won't wear them. But we had opposition from churches who didn't want to distribute condoms. And the Bush government administration, unfortunately, said that all family planning and so forth had to be based on abstinence. We couldn't teach them about contraception and so forth, or we lose any U.S. grants.
So even if it was HIV prevention, you couldn't teach condom use?
No. That's changed. Obama changed that the first day he was in office. So that's a big help. The epidemic is still going on. It's worldwide. It has not had the effect on population control that people thought. They thought with all these people dying, that would overcome the population increase, which in Kenya, Tanzania is about 4% per annum. So when I first went to Kenya, there were 3 million people. Today, there are 35 million people.
Good heavens.
And that is, in my view, one of the number one worldwide health problem is population containment.
Very much so. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who think, oh, well, war and plagues will take care of population. They never have in the past.
No, they probably won't. We're probably going to get some plagues, and certainly wars come along that we don't even know about yet. So far the HIV hasn't had that effect, but it's had terrible, you know, tragic effects on a lot of people.
So you still go every year to Africa?
Yeah, we just got back. My wife loves it. And as you know, it wasn't all work and no play. When we were there, we got to meet a lot of people, and we spent a lot of time observing animals, and we love them. That's what got me into sculpture.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. You've got an exhibition that is currently showing at the Gerald Peters Gallery right here in Santa Fe, and they're mostly animals and people from Africa.
Entirely. Yeah, that's what I do.
Small bronze sculptures.
Small bronze sculptures, yeah.
But you started doing that fairly recently.
10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Well, when I retired from surgery, I'm kind of an A personality, and I can't sort of sit around and read all day. It's not possible. And I've had some orthopedic surgery, which precludes my playing golf and stuff like that. So it's left me with fly fishing, which I can still do and love. But mainly I had to have something to do. And sculpture came along, and it was perfect for me as a surgeon, because I had a certain knowledge of anatomy, and I could use my hands. And I sculpt every day with a great friend of mine here in Santa Fe named Ted Flicker,
whom we've had on this show, the wonderful theater person and director of The President's Analyst, which was my favorite movie of all time. But anyway, so you learned sculpture from Ted?
Ted and I learned together. We started at the same time. We used to ride horses together, and we both got out of that because the horses got lame, or we got lame or something. So we decided we were interested in sculpture, and we had a great friend named Paul Moore, and who was and is a great sculptor. He's now at the University of Oklahoma. And we said, Paul, we want to learn to sculpt. What should we do? Should we go to class? Should we go to school? What should we do? He said, no, just come and watch me. And he was very generous with his time, and we just hung out with him in his studio for a while, and then he gave us a project to do, and then he critiqued us, and he's still doing that.
Are you sculpting from memory? Did you use photographs?
No, I sculpt from photographs, which for me is the fun of it, because every photograph I have had some kind of a story about it, meant something. And so the animals, when I see them, it brings back that whole picture.
Well, how about is it a rhinoceros with his jaws wide open? It's a hippopotamus.
Hippopotamus. Actually, a hippopotamus is the most dangerous animal in Africa, by the way. It kills more people than any other. Not because they're mean, but because they come out of the rivers at night to feed. They're grazers. They can go miles away from the river, but then they come back to the river. And if you happen to be in the way on a trail or something, you can get killed, you'd get hurt. This particular hippopotamus charged my wife and I one day, and he actually wasn't on land as I predicted. Pictured him here. He was in the water, and we'd seen a lot of them, been around a lot of them, and never had a problem. But this guy had a wound on his neck. It looked like somebody had hurt him, and we saw him jump in the river. We were in a little tiny boat, like a dugout canoe, and we saw him jump in the river with this wound, and he started swimming towards us, and we thought, well, he'll go down like they all do. And suddenly he came up about 20 feet from the boat, and he wasn't going down. He was coming straight at us with his mouth wide open. and there was a little outboard motor on the back of this dugout canoe, and an African was madly pumping the motor trying to get it going. And obviously we got away because we're still here. But
right.
So but my wife got a picture of him with his mouth wide open.
Good heavens.
So I expanded that, took him out of the water, put him on the land, and then sculpted him.
Was that your scariest moment in Africa?
No. The scariest moment I had in Africa is in my book, too. I went on a surgical mission to Uganda, to a leprosarium, when Idi Amin, actually, the day that Idi Amin took the government.
Yeah.
And our airplanes have always had the cross-border clearances from Uganda, Tanzania. We could cross the borders without landing. And I was going on the surgical mission with a friend of mine. And I got to the Uganda border, and I called in Entebbe, the airport. I said, this is 5Y Doc, flying doctors on the way to Sarate in the north of Uganda. And they said, you'll come and land. And I said, please check our clearances. We are cleared to cross the border at all times. They said, you come and land or we send a fighter plane. So we thought we'd better do that. And we landed in the midst of the revolution going on. Airport was covered with young men in dungarees and Ray-Ban glasses and Uzi submachine guns. And they arrested us. And we didn't know what was going on. And finally, they wouldn't speak to us for a while. Finally, one man that clearly seemed to be the boss said, General Amin has taken over the government, and he were prisoners. And we said, well, we're Americans, and we have American passports. So please take us to the American consul, get him down here. He says, he's in jail. And then we realized that we might be in trouble.
Right.
Because, you know, and I got a little hot-headed, which is a stupid thing to do, because when you have young revolutionaries like that in Africa, especially, you know, you can get shot very easily. And so anyway, we talked our way out of it and finished our surgical mission, came back the next day and had to land all over again. And they stripped the airplane out, looked at all of our surgical instruments, spread them out all over the ground, just basically kind of humiliated us. But
stomped all over them,
yeah,
ruined a lot of them.
Ruined a lot of them. That I wasn't frightened at that point, but the day before I was probably as frightened as I've been anywhere.
So you're still doing this. If people who are, you know, Americans or people who are listening to this program, nurses, doctors, want to get involved, is there a place for them?
Yes and no. We do take some volunteers still. It's hard to take nurses because these countries have work permits that are very difficult. Obviously, they want to have African nurses as much as they can. If we have a specialty, some nurse or any other medical personnel who has a very distinct, unique skill or technique or knowledge, we can do that. As I said, our staff of 1,000 odd people in all of these countries is now 98% Africanized. But if people want to contact us and they're interested, then we can give them the address.
Yeah, it's AMREF, AMREF.org. They can go there, and it's actually located in Kenya, but there, as you said, there's offices all over the world, including the United States.
New York City, yes. Yeah. Well, they can call the office in New York City.
So there you were for decades flying on little airplanes in East Africa, doing surgeries, bringing a lot of help to people who need it very badly, giving so much. What did you get back? What did you get from Africa, from African people, African culture, African land?
Well, I met an awful lot of really interesting and wonderful people to begin with. But naturally, I got an awful lot of self-satisfaction, you know, doing this work. When you're doing something that nobody else could do and you're the only game in town, it's pretty exciting. So I got a lot of satisfaction out of the work. And now that I've retired from my profession, from active practice, I still get a lot of satisfaction out of being involved in this. And it's sad but true that too many doctors, when they retire, have nothing but golf left.
Right.
You know, and they soon get bored.
You tell a story in your book about going to a place where there was a 9-year-old boy who was very, very sick, and a man comes to you who later turns out to be a very gifted politician, but he comes to you and says, you know, I don't know if this is something to worry about or not, but this boy seems very sick, and you bring your own 9-year-old son. What was it like pass this on to your own children?
Well, I don't think my 9-year-old son ever forgot that. It happened to be a Maasai warrior.
Right.
And the Maasai are nomads. They travel. And we were camping in Tanzania with my son when he was 9 years old. And there was a local health, I don't know, the woman who ran this kind of camp that we were in came to me and she said, there's a Maasai that has a sick child. And would you go look at him? And I said, sure. So I went down out of the camp, got into a little Jeep and went down to the river and looked at this kid. Well, he had this open sore on his head, and he had some lymph nodes in his neck. And I had read about anthrax. I'd never seen it in my life. And there are two forms of anthrax. There's one that comes like this form of anthrax. And I thought, I don't know what this is. And so I said to his father, and these were very rural, primitive, I said to his father, you know, I don't know what he has, but will you bring him here in the morning, and I'll get a blood test, because I was going to send for one of our airplanes to bring me a kid out to test this kid, because if he had anthrax, it's highly contagious, and it could. And he said, no, he wouldn't do it. And I said, well, if you don't, he might die. And he says, so what? You know, everybody dies.
And this is his own son.
Yeah.
It's such a different culture.
Different, entirely different. Because the Maasai believe that you die and come back as your ancestors anyway, as a fly. So they don't feel anything about death. They don't fear it. They don't feel about it. Of course, the more educated ones today do. So he said, no, that's a... And I said, well, maybe your cattle will die. Now I had his attention. That was serious business, because that's all they live for. That's their money. That's their. And he said, I said, your cattle might get this disease. They might have it, because cattle can get anthrax. So he agreed he'd bring the kid back the next day. The next morning, so that night I called on the radio. One of our planes brought back some test tubes and some stuff to draw blood. I went back down there, and the Maasai camp gone. They'd left.
They just left.
They just left.
But you never heard of an anthrax outbreak after that?
Obviously it was not anthrax.
Right. Well, it's just about time to go. Dr. Tom Rees is a surgeon, writer, and sculptor, and his work, his bronze sculptures, are up for another week or so at the Gerald Peters Gallery until the 16th of May. And once again, he's one of the founders of the Flying Doctors of East Africa. For more information on them, you can go to amref.org, amref.org. Dr. Rees, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.